Welcome to the Union Tribune's Aztecs Hoopla podcast. My name is Jay Posner. I'm the sports editor, joined as always by our Aztecs basketball beat writer, Mark Ziegler. Mark's back from Las Vegas, but unlike the Aztecs, who have, I believe, 12 days between games, Mark will not be taking all those 12 days off. I might give you maybe 1 or 2 days, Mark.
Nice guy that you are.
Exactly. But make sure you do some expense reports on those on those days.
Sure.
But you've written a lot about what happened over the weekend, obviously, with the Utah State game, which was odd in the sense that, you know, it came just 24 hours or not even 24 hours after the opposite had happened, where the Aztecs had fallen behind by 16 against Boise State, came roaring back and got a victory to go into the finals against another team they'd beaten twice this year, Utah State. Got off to a, I don't want to say a hot start, but I guess a good start. I mean, they played really well defensively, but I felt like, and I think I even texted you at one point using a term that we always joke about in soccer about whether the Aztecs would be ruining some missed opportunities. It just felt like when Utah State went 13 minutes without scoring, that the Aztecs should have been up by more than 16. It felt like, you know, if they could have been up by 22, 24, and at that point you figure, okay, they're probably safe. But they didn't play all that well either offensively in that span. And so they ended up blowing the lead. It came down to the last couple shots. Aztec's best player missed a three. Utah State's best player made even a more difficult three. What do you take from that game based on kind of what happened at the end? Was there anything that you felt like the Aztecs could have done differently in those last couple possessions, both offensively and defensively?
No, I think both teams played it pretty textbook and did everything that they wanted to do. I mean, the Aztecs, Malachi Flynn got an open three, and they, what had happened in the play before, they'd run a play where they Matt Mitchell comes up from the baseline and sets a ball screen, and Malachi Flynn dribbles left, which is his preferred direction. And Utah State screwed up the switch. They weren't sure if they were going to switch or if Sam Merrill, who was guarding Malachi Flynn, was going to come over the top of it and stay on him or go under it. And he just kept going and then just stopped and pulled up and shot a really easy for him 15-footer, and they scored. And that had put them ahead by a point. So after Utah State, Sam Merrill got fouled and tied it.
Well, he didn't really get fouled. He committed a foul, and he committed a foul that wasn't called, and then got a foul called on him that probably wasn't a call. But anyway, that was just, it was 1 point at that time, because he actually missed a free throw, which he almost
which
never
is very rare
yeah,
for
he almost
him.
Never
yeah.
does.
So anyway, it's tied, and Utah State called a timeout, not San Diego State. Utah State called a timeout probably to discuss what just happened, mm-hmm. saying, okay, because right after Malachi Flynn went over that ball screen and scored, Sam Merrill, if you watch the replay, puts his arms up and kind of shrugs like, whoa, what are we doing here?
Right,
so they were
right.
confused. And I think they knew what was coming. And San Diego State, to its credit, did, of course you're going to run the same play. Let's see how they defend it this time. So they called a timeout to get themselves straightened out, and they decided to switch it. So they ran the same play. Matt Mitchell comes up, sets the ball screen, and Malachi comes off the ball screen. And Justin, being 6'7", not very fleet of foot, is on him. So he drives hard at him and then steps back a little bit and had plenty of space to shoot what is really his trademark shot. Left side, mm-hmm. step back, three-pointer. I mean, I've seen him practice it hundreds of times a day, and he just missed it. And I don't think you can really blame him for taking it and blame them for when he took it in the shot clock. It really didn't matter if they took it early or late. Utah State was still going to get the ball back with probably like 9 or 10 seconds minimum, probably more like a minimum of 15
right.
to 20. And their possession was going to be the same thing if he missed it. They were going to, you know, run it down and take the last shot and either go to overtime or win the game. And on Utah State's last play, they did the right thing by not calling timeout, got into a 1-4 low set where they pushed everybody on the baseline to deter help. And San Diego State had their best defender on Utah State's best player, and he made an incredibly hard shot. And if you look at the slow motion replay, super slow motion, KJ Fagan's hand actually contacts the shooting arm and shooting wrist of Sam Merrill as he's releasing the ball. I'm not sure it was a foul, but as close as you can get without fouling him and being in great defense. So you really can't complain either way for the shot the Aztecs got or the shot that they defended. One went in, one didn't.
Right. I think sometimes people are always looking for, you know, someone to blame, and, you know, it's usually the coach is the first one, but I'm not sure in this case that you could blame either coach, you know, for what they did. It seemed like they both got what they wanted, and, you know, sometimes guys miss shots. I mean, nobody makes 100% of their shots. I mean, you know, Michael Jordan didn't make all the game-winning or any all the shots he took either, and I just couldn't think about anything that could have been done differently, and you explained it well there. Coming off of that, though, and our colleague Bryce Miller, I thought, wrote a really good column after the game, just talking about the Aztecs and kind of what kind of team they are right now, and how, you know, this is not the same team that, you know, clobbered Creighton, beat BYU, came back and beat Iowa, even the same team that, you know, I guess it's been almost 2.5 weeks or so, that went up to Boise and just, you know, beat Boise State really quite easily in a difficult environment. And since then, and there were a few warning signs before then, but look, you're not going to go through. I mean, this is not a super team. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, this is a very good team, but this is not a team that's just going to go out and dominate all of its opponents. It's going to have some close games. It's going to have some halves where they, you know, lose a first half or something like that. But obviously the last couple of weeks and then into the tournament, a little bit, I guess, unsettling maybe is the word. Where are you on kind of what kind of team this is right now, and what's a little bit different than we saw, you know, earlier in the season or even at Boise in the middle of last month?
Well, I think there's two sort of components here. One is them. Are they the same team? Probably not quite the same team. Certainly not the same team they were in late December and in the non-conference when they had Nathan Mensah as a rim protector. Their defense is a little bit different. Their offense is a little bit different. Yanni Wetzel's being asked to do quite a bit defensively, and, you know, I can wear him down offensively. And so, yeah, they're not the same team when you look at, you know, all different kinds of metrics and advanced metrics. And the one that's really staggering to me, and you look at, and I wrote this a couple weeks ago about how much time they spend trailing in basketball games. And through the most part, through the season, I mean, they almost never trailed. I mean, like something like 18 or 20 of their games, they trailed for less than 2 minutes. It's just staggering. Hmm. And recently they've been trailing quite a bit in games. And so, you know, that's one thing that's certainly a warning sign. And if you look at, you know, if they beat Boise State to go 26-0 and dominated that game, and since then they lose to UNLV, they almost lose to Colorado State at home. Both those games are at home. Then they win at Nevada, but they're down 13. They have to come back from 13 down in a tough environment to win that game. Then they come into the conference tournament. They're down 8 to a 12-20 Air Force team that just fired its coach. Then they play Boise State, and they're down 16 and have to come back and win that. And then they play Utah State, and they're up 16 and blow that lead. So there's just a lot of wobbling with the wheels. But the second thing that's going on is that everyone else isn't the same. And as basketball seasons go on, and remember, this is a very veteran team that came roaring out of the gates. A lot of guys who'd been there and done that and been through the college basketball wars, they were ready for the start of the season this year. They were way ahead of, you know, you talk about spring training and pitchers and, you know, and hitters, who's further ahead and all that, and offenses and defenses, who's further ahead coming out of summer preseason camp in the NFL. Well, it's kind of the same thing. They just came roaring out of the gate. They were way ahead of everybody else. Now teams are starting to catch up. Younger teams, they're freshmen, really are no longer freshmen. They've mm-hmm. been played in. So a team like Colorado State is much different than the one they played on December 4th with a bunch of freshmen who never played in a conference game before. And a team like Utah State went 1-4 for a stretch in January. They had a lot of injuries, a lot of behind-the-scenes drama. They sorted that out. They're a different team. They're a much better team. So I think it's the combination of the Aztecs, you know, having some issues and not being able to sustain their level as long in games as they were before, and other teams just getting better at this time of year and being able to match that effort for longer stretches as well.
Yeah, those are great points. And I wonder if somehow, because they kept winning after Mensah was sidelined with the pulmonary embolism, if we kind of overlooked his importance, because, you know, the Aztecs went another, I don't know, what, 8 weeks or so without losing. And so you just kind of figured, okay, well, yeah, sure, they're probably a better team with him, but, you know, they've adjusted, and Mitchell's in the starting lineup, and, you know, the bench isn't as strong as it was, but, you know, it hasn't really bothered him. But I guess, which brings us to the idea of whether Mensah's going to be back or not, but it seems now that you know, maybe they need Mensa more than we thought they needed him when they were just, you know, continuing to rampage through the schedule. So where are we on Nathan Mensa at this point, and what would be your best guess in terms of whether he's cleared in time to play the first weekend of the tournament, or if the Aztecs, you know, can get out of Sacramento the second weekend?
Well, if you look at, you know, the big question here is the standard of care for recommended standard of care for a pulmonary embolism is 3 months of anticoagulants or blood thinners, and that's really the big number there, 3 months.
And 3 months, just 3 months is not, I guess he didn't go on the blood thinners until very late in December, right?
So we're probably
3 months we'd be looking at kind of the last few days of March, right?
Yeah, so probably the second weekend, the middle weekend of the NCAA tournament would probably be about 3 months. And so the question is, can he get cleared a week early? The chances of him coming back and practicing this week are very slim. And so, as I understand it, so I think you're looking at, is he going to get cleared for the two games in Sacramento, and if they survive those, or would it be they'd have to survive those and he'd get cleared the following week? And, you know, it becomes a liability issue, I think, at a certain point. A doctor has to sign off on it, and, you know, and the doctor is on the line if something were to go wrong. And then you get the university's risk management department involved, and, you know, with coronavirus going around, I'm sure their antennas are quite heightened to risk right now.
Sure.
And liability. And so, you know, they're probably going to have to sign off as well to get him back before those 3 months. But I know he's seen a ton of specialists. He's had a ton of blood work. My understanding is that everything's been good so far. Everything is on track for him possibly to get cleared next week. But this is a situation completely out of the coach's hands. Brian Dutchess, I think, has done a very good job of sort of divorcing himself and not trying to put pressure on anybody in the medical profession to clear him or say, you know, we really need him, it would be great to have him back. He's just taken a step back and done what a veteran coach would do, who sees the bigger picture and just said, look, you do what's best for the kid, knowing that he really wants to get back. And they'll make a decision. And you know, we'll probably find out, you know, in the middle of next week. Well, I suspect if he does get cleared, it'll probably only be a day or two before that game, in the first game of the NCAA tournament. He might not even have a full practice in contact. He might just get, you know, put a uniform on and go out there and play. I mean, it could be that close.
Right. I know you're going to write about this today, and which will be online, you know, later this afternoon or this evening for people, depending on when people are hearing this. But that brings us to the next point, which is, what are the Aztecs going to do with all this time off? You know, they've had 2 days off already in terms of Sunday and Monday. We're taping this on Tuesday morning. They're not going to play again until a week from Friday, which I believe is the 20th, in Sacramento. So what's Brian Dutcher's plan for this? And it's certainly unusual. I mean, the Aztecs, I don't think, have been in this position, because even if you get eliminated from the conference tournament on the first day, that's still like 5 or 6 fewer days than these guys are going to have right now.
Yeah, and basketball, you know, basketball is such a rhythm sport. So there's advantages and disadvantages to this. And the advantage, obviously, is it allows them really rest. And I think there's probably been a residual effect when we, you know, talked earlier about what's happened to this team, the same team. When Nathan Mensa went out, it really increased the minutes, the meaningful minutes for the starters. And they were in a lot, and then it gets compounded because they're not just in playing more minutes, but they're playing more minutes in really stressful situations where you really are locked in and going hard because the games are getting closer and they're not dominating teams as much. And so I think there's a residual effect where they just wore down a little bit. The starters wore down and you start seeing more and more guys, you know, instead of just having one guy be off on the night, you'd have two or maybe three guys with really dead legs. And so this really gives them a chance to rest legs and kind of rejuvenate. Now, the risk on that is you get rusty, and it's a rhythm sport, and you lose your rhythm. And if you know, all you got to do is look. The only kind of stretch that was similar to this was during finals week, and I think they had 10 days off, or they had 2 weeks off before they played Utah, and they purposely scheduled NAIA San Diego Christian College 4 days before that. So they had 10-day break before they played Christian, and they did that just because they knew they were going to be rusty. And if you remember that game, and one of the things I'll write about is they were behind in the first half of that game. And it was certainly close for a lot longer than you'd expect it to be for a team that really wasn't a very good NAIA team this year. and doesn't have the athleticism or the size of the Aztecs, and it shouldn't have been close at all. But they were rusty, and so that is the big risk. And so I think what their plan is to balance rest with rust, and they'll hopefully will have a scrimmage against. They're going to try to get some of their former players, and the new NCAA rule allows certain number of practices with former players who just happen to be in town, and you can sort of mass those together and have a scrimmage against them. They did it in the preseason once, and it was really successful. I think it really helped them, and I think they're going to try to gather up some guys. A guy like Jamal Franklin is one guy they're going to ask. He plays in the Chinese League, which has been postponed, so he's back home. Trey Kell is coming off an injury. He's now healed. He's in town. Valentine Azundu, the shot blocker from a few years ago, his big, you know, size, mm-hmm. presence will give him that to look at. He's in town. So, they'll take as many as they can find, and they'll add some walk-ons, and they'll get refs, and they'll just play a very informal scrimmage, but it'll just give them – they'll go against somebody other than themselves. And so I think that'll be the second component of it.
You think they'll try to set it up even kind of with a little bit of a game situation with clocks and the scoreboard just to give it a little bit of atmosphere?
Yeah, I mean, the first one they did in the Jam Center, so it wasn't like in an arena. I would think if they had their, depending on what the Viejas schedule is, if they had their choice, they'd probably want to have it in Viejas Arena in case, also to give you the players a feel of playing in an empty arena in case that it comes to that with coronavirus at the NCAA tournament. Mm-hmm. So they'll do that. The one issue they ran into before was that they had five, maybe six alums, but they weren't in great shape. Because it was after their seasons, they had just taken breaks. They hadn't, sort of ramped up again to get back into it. And after their professional seasons, and so they kind of got tired after basically a half.
Right.
That will be the interesting thing to see how long they can sustain. Now Jamal Franklin's in ridiculous shape, so he could probably play forever. But I'm not sure with the other guys how long they could actually go. But that's my guess is they'll try to make it as game-like as possible. They bring in actual NCAA officials who live in town, who have nothing going on or just around, and then they try to go from there.
So they can make some bad calls just so they can kind of stay in rhythm with how the games will be officiated in the tournament as well.
Absolutely.
Right. And
absolutely.
I'm assuming, and unfortunately, they're probably not going to get Kawhi Leonard to come and play in one of these
They joked about getting him. Yeah, no, I don't think he would. Although, knowing him, he's such a loyal guy. If they asked him, he probably would try to make it.
Right. Yeah, I haven't looked at the Clippers schedule, but if there was a few hours, he could come down here and play. This weekend, actually this week, I guess, conference tournaments, with the exception of the Ivy League, which canceled today, are scheduled for all week. The WCC final is tonight, with Gonzaga playing St. Mary's. I doubt that that'll have any impact. I think even if Gonzaga were to lose, they would probably still get a one seed over the Aztecs, right?
Yeah, I think so, and I don't think they're going to lose.
I don't think they're much better
than St. Mary's.
Although it's weird how they had all those tough games with USF during the regular season and again last night. But it's, we've talked before, it's a matchups. A lot of times it's about matchups, and there must have been something about those teams. But in terms of seeding, it seems the consensus now is the Aztecs would be a two seed. And remind us again what the committee said when they were here a few weeks ago about two seeds, and because I have seen a couple bracket people have the Aztecs as a two seed but moving them back east, like putting them in the same regional as Dayton, I guess on the theory that you would have the weakest one seed would get the strongest two seed in the region. But the committee said that's really not how it works, right?
Right. What it told us when they were here at Viejas Arena, and that was the executive vice president for basketball, who oversees the whole tournament, and then the chair of the selection committee, mm-hmm. The vice chair. And what they said was that with one seed and two seeds, it's different. They're going to geographically try to protect the top four seeds in the first weekend. But when it comes to the second weekend, they're only really trying to geographically protect the one and two seeds. And the way it works is, the way it was explained to us, is the one seeds, you take your four one seeds and you rank them one through four. And you just go right down the list and you go and assign them to the closest regional to them, second weekend regional. Mm-hmm. So if Kansas is number one, they would go to Indianapolis. And if Gonzaga is number two, they'd go to L.A. And if Dayton is number three, they probably would go to New York. And if Baylor's number four, they would go to Houston. And then they do the same thing with two seeds. And San Diego State should be the only West Coast two seed. I don't think Oregon, even if it wins the Pac-12 tournament, will get high enough to pass them. I mean, they're probably in that – yes, it's in the five or six range right now if you were to rank the teams, or the NCAA does. And so they'll almost certainly be, when they go down the list, the only West Coast team, and they'll send them to the West. And so that's they should really end up in LA if the NCAA does what it says it does. Now, we've seen the NCAA Tournament Selection Committee before, and there's a lot of times there's head-scratching decisions, and they try to explain it afterwards. They're basically doing whatever they want to do, rules aside or policies aside. So we'll have to wait and see, but that's the way it should go.
Right. And as far as teams to watch for the Aztecs to be a one seed, if they would even want to be, although, you know, it's kind of a conflict, and we've talked about it many times. Do you want to be there's something about being a one seed that's really cool, but would you rather be a one seed and have to travel to New York? Or would you rather be a two seed and, you know, take a bus to LA? But aside from that, are there any teams we should be watching this week that would maybe cause the Aztecs to move up to a one seed? I would think Dayton in the Atlantic 10 tournament, and maybe Baylor again. I mean, they've lost three out of five.
Right. If Baylor loses in the first round of the conference tournament to somebody who's not very good, then I could see them dropping below the Aztecs. But you know, I think Baylor will probably stay ahead of them. Or if they move down, someone would move ahead. You know, Florida State could move in there into that top four, mm-hmm. and Baylor could be bumped to a two seed. I could see that happening. You know, and so Florida State would be one team to watch. They're kind of the best of the ACC right now, but they could get knocked off. Dayton, certainly, if they take a bad loss, that might bump them back down. You know, they're really, you know, people say, what's the difference between a one and a two besides the aura of being a one seed? You know, the one difference, too, is you can get a pretty good team as a 15 seed now, because when the NCAA changed its format and they went to play-in games for the 16 seeds, so four 16 seeds play and have play-in games for two spots, that bumped everybody down two notches. And so you got a couple 14, what used to be 14 seeds, now becoming 15 seeds. Uh-huh. And so two of the 15 seeds are what used to be 14 seeds. And there's kind of a break there between the 14s and the 15s. 14s are usually decent teams from mid-major conference, East Tennessee State or something like that. Maybe a Big West team. And so you can run into a decent team, like a Hawaii was a few years ago, when they were pretty good. Or UC Irvine and those type of teams. And so they could run into a tougher team than if they were a one. And so that's something to keep an eye on, too, to see how things shake out. The first game might not be a gimme. They might actually have to work a little bit for it. And then in the second game, the difference between a one and a two is, you know, you're looking at an 8-9 seed if you're a one, and two, it could be a 7 or a 10. Those are all really pretty good teams. They're mostly power conference teams. And that's the game that Aztec fans should really have their eye on. That's going to be the tough game for me, because they won't have played a team of that caliber since Thanksgiving, really, or Thanksgiving weekend. And just keep this in mind. Utah State, a team they just lost to, and it was a very close game, is probably going to be an 11 seed. And you're looking at playing a 7 or an 8 probably in the second round. And that's a much better team. That's a significantly better team that they'll be looking at. So it's going to be a tough to get out of that first weekend.
Of course, Virginia could tell you that there's some tough 16 seeds as well every once in a while. So the only other thing, and I just thought of this while you were talking about Baylor possibly getting knocked down to a 2, and I wonder if this could possibly mess things up a little bit, but this is just one of those sort of out there type things. But let's say that Florida State ends up as a 1 and goes to Houston as the 1 seed, and Gonzaga is the 1 seed in L.A., would the committee look at San Diego State as a 2 going to L.A. 2 hours up the road? Obviously, a ton of Aztec fans would be there. Baylor would be a 2 seed looking at Houston. Would they put – you're kind of putting the 1 seeds at a – if you're the 1 seed, you're thinking, wait a minute, we're the 1 seed, and yet here's the 2 seed getting home, basically home court advantage. And I just wonder if somewhere – and if this shows up, I can claim that I thought of this. But I just wonder if they might flop those two and say, you know what, we don't want to give the advantage to the two seed, so we're going to send San Diego State to Houston, and we're going to send Baylor to L.A.
It's a really good thought, and this is where they talk out of both sides of their mouth, because we had the exact same scenario when they did their initial bracket projections, and San Diego State was a 1 in the East, and Duke was a 2 in the East, and they were asked that exact question: would you send Duke to the East still, knowing that they would have a huge advantage over San Diego State in terms of fan support and in terms of familiarity with the building? And the answer was, absolutely we would. We would just go, we have to keep the integrity of the seeds, and this is our system.
Uh-huh.
So they're on record saying that.
Okay.
And that is the chairman of the committee. So it'll be very interesting to me to see if they did do that and flipped it, it would be the classic, you know, talking out of both sides of their mouth. But again, it's happened before.
Right.
And people need to remember about the committee is not the same through all the years. It changes. There's 10 people on it, and people are always cycling off, and new people are cycling on. So it's this, it's living, breathing changes. It's like an amoeba. It just keeps changing, and it's only 10 people. So the opinion or the policies or the procedures of those 10 people can also change. How much do they value NET? How much do they value KenPom? How much do they look at, you know, just quality wins? How much do they look at the full body of work versus the last 10 games? All that stuff changes all the time. And so you can't definitively ever say, well, this is how they should act and will act. Can't
right.
predict it.
Right. All right. Well, the good thing is that on Sunday, sometime after between 3 and 3:30, we will find out. And you and I will come back and talk about what happened and what's ahead on probably on Monday of next week, so everyone can look forward to that. But until then, everyone enjoy your week, stay out of the rain, and enjoy all the basketball on TV. And the selection show again is at 3 o'clock on CBS on Sunday. So we will talk to you next week.